All right, so in our last episode, we were talking with Kim Scott, the author of Radical Candor, and we were unpacking the polarity of compassion and candor in leadership. Most of us can easily fall into that trap of believing our leadership style has to be one or the other. And some of this comes down to our personality, but a lot of it has to do with our thinking. If you are a leader who leans towards a more compassionate leadership style, it's often because you really focus on the benefits of compassion, like being well-liked, and individuals feeling understood. And you probably also focus a little bit or are afraid of the effects of overusing candor, which are being disliked, conflict, individuals feeling unappreciated, stagnation. Now, the opposite is true for more candid leaders, right? So they focus on the benefits of candor, which are improvement, growth, and accountability, while fearing the overuses of compassion, which are a lack of accountability, stagnation, as well as a few other things. So what does it look like to be both compassionate and candid? What's it like to integrate those two ideas? Well, that's what Kim Scott is going to teach us today in what is an episode jam-packed full of practical ways to improve our communication and feedback. Welcome to the Coaching Culture Podcast. I'm your host, JP Nurbin, and I'm joined by my friend and co-host, Nate Sanderson. The mission of this podcast is to help you become a better leader and build a better culture. In addition to this podcast, I'm the founder of TOC, which provides one-on-one coaching and consulting for leaders. Learn more about us at tocculture.com. This episode is brought to you by the TOC newsletter. Every Thursday, our newsletter includes two things you don't want to miss out on. Firstly, the notes to that week's podcast episode. Whether you're listening while driving the car, out for a run, or doing the dishes, we don't want you to miss the biggest takeaways from each episode. Secondly, each newsletter is a short article from myself or Nate on leadership and culture. These articles are designed to inspire, encourage, and provide practical insights into leadership and culture building. Our content is a perfect fit for anyone who wants to stay up to date with the latest trends and insights in culture building. You can subscribe to the newsletter at tocculture.com or by clicking on the link in the details of each episode.
Yeah, I think one thing that I thought about too when I was listening to the book was, and I don't know that this phrase is where this comes from, but the idea of normalizing our presence as a leader. In other words, yeah, I'm only popping into your classroom as a principal when you've done something wrong or you haven't disciplined correctly. All of a sudden, you know, I'm going to be tense when I see that leader versus, you know, even this morning, I've just been thinking about this. We're trying to build a youth program out in our basketball program. And when I walk from the parking lot to the high school, I have the option of going on the sidewalk or I can cut through the hallways of the middle school. And when I do that, I start to see some of our middle school kids that I wouldn't see in class or that I wouldn't run into otherwise. Yeah. You know, just those little, Daniel Coyle talked about those little tiny collisions add up over time, right? They're tiny micro deposits in that relationship account. And I think those are important too, because, and this brings us kind of to our next question here, in coaching, a lot of times, there's this such a rapid back and forth oftentimes with feedback, both positively and negatively. And I think one of the things that we can encounter, and this is not just with players, this happens with assistant coaches, this happens with parents, is that when they see criticism coming or they see feedback coming that may be uncomfortable or that may challenge their ego or their confidence or whatever it might be,
or we
see
child.
These defense mechanisms start to surface, right?
Yes, for sure.
And you talked about fight or flight, but you know, we see it also in deflecting responsibility, blaming other people, victimizing themselves. You know, it can manifest in all these different ways where players then become resistant to receiving whatever it is that information is they need to get better. So I guess my question is, when we're trying to deliver some of that, you know, some of those notifications that are, you know, grounded in trying to help them improve. They're not personal attacks, you know, which is another phrase we hear sometimes, right, about coaches. What are some strategies for us when we see the defenses start to rise to be able to, you know, perhaps put them at ease so that we can have that positive flow of communication?
Yeah, I think a couple of things here. One is when you notice that sort of someone is either sad or mad, that's your cue to move up on the care personally dimension just a little bit. And so I thought that's what I thought my son's baseball coach did so well, is he saw this kid get, you know, these were young kid. They were like 9 at the time. He's older now. But he saw this kid sort of tear up, get upset. And he stopped and he sort of explained that he did not back off his challenge. What he did not do is say, oh, it's okay that you missed the base, you know. But what he did do is say, look, you can be a great player. And I'm telling you this because you can't fix a problem if you're not aware of it. And so I thought it was very effective. The kid like bucked up and actually looked prouder of himself after this happened than before. And the whole team then, it wasn't only this one kid who was upset, but the whole team was now more open to the coach's feedback because the coach said, I'm telling you this because I care about you. And sometimes just saying something like that can be a really great response. I think the other thing that is important to keep in mind when you're noticing these sad or mad emotions is not to say, don't take it personally, or you're not listening to me. Like, use your I statements. You're trying to own your communication and you're trying to show this person that you care about them. And that is what you do when the person is sad or mad. It's tempting. It's tempting to try to distance yourself from someone else's negative emotions because it's like none of us like making. I mean, I guess there are psychopaths who do like making people upset, but I'm assuming none of your listeners are psychopaths. That, you know, they chose this line of work because they care about these kids. Mostly. And so you want to make sure that you're taking that extra beat to pay attention to the emotions. And just remember that when we communicate with each other, we communicate on an intellectual level, but also on an emotional level at the same time. There are two things happening at the same time. And if you dismiss all the emotional signals that the other person is sending you, when you're talking to them, you're just not going to communicate very well. So don't sort of distance yourself from them. Don't say it's not okay for you to have an emotional response. Remember that radical candor gets measured not at your mouth, not at your intentions, but at the other person's ear. And, you know, we spend a lot, people care a lot about sports. And when it's not going well, it can feel like a gut punch. But that doesn't mean that they're a bad sportsman or sports person, or that they're, you know, they're unprofessional or something. It means that they care, and that's a good thing. And so you sort of want to adjust for those emotions. Don't dismiss them. So in other words, you want to go, if you think about radical candor as like a 2x2, on the vertical line is care personally, the horizontal line is challenge directly. If the other person is sad or mad, you want to move up on the care personally dimension. Now, let's pause for a moment and talk about someone who starts yelling at you. And my guess is those are usually the parents, not the kids, but could be either one. So what do you do? It's pretty hard to care personally about someone who's yelling at you. You know, I don't know about you all, but in those moments, it's my instinct to start yelling back. And then now I'm the asshole, you know, and that's not what I want to happen. Sometimes I just am silent and I retreat to kind of a self-protective, manipulative insincerity when somebody yells at me. So in those moments, I try to tell myself, get curious, not furious. Like, what's, you know, what is, and if I feel like the person is yelling at me in a way that is bullying me, that, you know, that is really, has crossed a line from normal aggression to bullying, Then I'll drop my I statements. You know, I don't think I was clear enough here. I'll drop that statement and I'll say, what's going on for you here? Like, why are you behaving this way? Or even sometimes a you non sequitur. Where'd you get that shirt? Like, you just got to push back a little bit on the person. And if the person persists, if there's a parent who persists in bullying you, I think you got to tell them they can't come to the game. Like, you got to create some consequences for that kind of bullying because it's not okay. And if one player is bullying another player, you got to create consequences for that. That's your job as a leader.
I'm curious, just as a quick follow-up to that, one of the books that we've used a lot in the content for our retreats and working with coaches is Never Split the Difference by Chris Voss. And he talks about accusation audits, which I've really messed around with quite a bit in my player-to-player, you know, conversations when it comes to there's a misunderstanding or, you know, this is going to be difficult to move you out of the lineup or something like that. But really starting with, what do I anticipate the defense to be, and can I vocalize that so that we're acknowledging, you know, this is hard or this could be challenging or, you know, whatever it might be. I just wonder if you've seen that, you know, in all your corporate experience, are there leaders that are using that kind of a strategy to try to disarm some of that in their communication?
So it is my experience that it's pretty hard to predict another person's emotional response, and it's impossible to control another person's emotional response. And so my instinct is to just say the thing, and then notice the person's response and respond accordingly. Because very often, like if somebody's not going to be, they know they probably have a sense that they're not going to be in the lineup, and say, "Look, I know you." So if you wanted to, if you wanted to try to take an extra beat to show you care about this person before you say the thing that you imagine is going to be hard for them to hear, by all means, do that. You know, I know you care about winning this game, and I've made a decision that is going to help us win. And the decision is to take you out of the lineup, but, you know, you can still be a great player. Here are the things I want you to work on or whatever. But I think that we make a mistake very often when we anticipate, when we dread, we give too much emotional room to dreading these conversations. I would say 9 times out of 10, when you deliver the hard message, the person is almost relieved because they have a sense of what's going to happen. And if you deliver it quickly and respectfully without too much preamble, then my experience is that's what works best. Because you can come off as insincere or patronizing, and you can also just be wrong about how the other person is going to respond. I have found when it comes to radical candor, I was teaching a class at a business school recently, and one of the students said, "When it comes to feedback, I have this existential dread." And I think that's a good way to put it. We do have this existential dread, but I think we also have a negativity bias. Like 9 times out of 10, it goes better. The conversations go better than you think they will. Now, 1 time out of 10, you will have a train wreck. And so I don't want to pretend like it's always going to be fine. But let's optimize for the 9 times out of 10, not the 1 time out of 10.
Yeah, there's two things I really want to point out that I really appreciate. One is just, sometimes we sugarcoat it, or we try to change so it just goes down a little bit smoother. And typically, they either don't get the message, or it doesn't really help because they see what we're doing.
Or it makes it worse. I think it's often called the shit sandwich. You know, nobody likes the shit sandwich where you say, "Oh, you know, Kim, I really like your bookshelf. You know, I hate your ideas, but your glasses are pretty cool." Like that does not make it any better.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that. There's something also you know, you're talking about how we receive feedback. Those were some great strategies, and I really appreciate you talking about the boundaries as well with parents, because there's a little side story. When I was reading Radical Candor, you know, 4 or 5 months ago, there's a quote in there where you said, "If a person is bold enough to criticize you, do not critique their criticism. If you see somebody criticize and appear inappropriately, say something. But if somebody criticizes you inappropriately, your job is to listen with the intent to understand and then reward the candor." And I thought it was brilliant. It was a very challenging statement. It's very hard for us to do that. But I shared that with some of our coaches in our WhatsApp group chat. And we had an AD who kind of chimed in and is like, "Well, yeah, to an extent, but then there's this line they cross and you really have to enforce that boundary."
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that's really true. I mean, one of the, in my second book, Just Work, I talk about how often bias, prejudice, and bullying masquerade as feedback. And so if you have a parent who is bullying you, you do not have to take that. In fact, it's your job actually not to take it and to create some at least conversational consequences for that bullying. And if it persists, you got to create some other kinds of consequences.
Yeah, now we're going to talk about your new book in a second, but there's one other thing that's just kind of just came up for me earlier in the conversation. That was around this idea of, you know, the feedback, and when we're giving it to, does it change for when we're giving it down the chain of command and up the chain of command? So just imagine like a coach in a program at a collegiate level giving it to their assistant coach around something they have observed in the assistant coach that they seem to be unaware of, but an effect, you know, a negative effect they're having on the athletes, the program. You know, I'm just curious, does the way that that head coach give that to the assistant vary as if, you know, would your advice change for the assistant coach having to give a head coach feedback? You know, like, I feel like giving feedback up the chain of command is oftentimes way more scary.
Yeah, I think that the goal here is to get on a level playing field. I mean, if we go back to where we started, which is with a relationship, there are few things that are more damaging to a human relationship than a power imbalance. So if you are the head coach, it's your job to sort of lay that power down. And if you are the assistant coach, it's your job to kind of step up and get on a level playing field. So in theory, the order of operations for radical candor for both the head coach and the assistant coach are the same. I want to acknowledge that in practice, it feels way different. And I will say also that one of the things I've learned since the book came out is how people often, even the, you know, the head coach, the CEO, they dread giving feedback to their employees just as much as their employees dread giving feedback to them. But it does, it's a different, the way the dread manifests is different. But the solution is the same for each. The solution is to follow this order of operations. Solicit feedback first. And this is not a Six Sigma thing. Like you can do all these things in one day, but solicit feedback first. You want to make sure you know where that other person is coming from and what they think you may be doing that's contributing to the problem. So solicit feedback first. Then you want to give more praise than criticism. You want to make sure that you're sharing what you appreciate about working with that person. And it's not kissing up if you're doing that to your boss. It's actually letting them know what to do more of. And then you want to also make sure that you're giving criticism, that you're not holding on to things for too long, and that you're gauging how that criticism is landing. And so in other words, don't try to predict how the person is going to react. Say the thing and then respond to how they actually do react. And if they're sad or mad, move up on care personally. If they're brushing you off, as will happen, then you've got to move over on challenge directly. And if they're bullying you, move over on challenge directly. They can be mad, but they can't bully you. And we can talk about where that line is. It's hard to define. And then you want to encourage radical candor. So don't allow someone to talk badly about another person who's not in the conversation behind their back. So for example, I had a colleague who worked on Wall Street, and she was assigned a new boss. She got a new boss. And this guy was known to be the biggest jerk on Wall Street, which was frankly saying something. And so she was a little nervous about this new assignment. And she adopted a mantra, there is only love. And she promised herself she wasn't going to talk badly about this guy to anyone, even her own husband. She was only going to give voice to the things she appreciated about him, except if she was mad at him, she was going to tell him directly. And you know, I don't think it was the easiest couple of years of her life, but she had a reasonable relationship with this boss, with his reputation.
This episode is brought to you by the TOC one-on-one coaching program. We're dedicated to helping leaders and organizations build an extraordinary culture that puts people first. At TOC, we believe that coaches need coaches, and we're here to provide you with the practical guidance and support you need to succeed. Our program includes weekly one-on-one coaching calls with myself or Nate, who will serve as your trusted sounding board and help you navigate any challenges you may face. You'll also have access to our culture assessments and 360 feedback, which provide valuable insights into your leadership style, as well as personalized plans for creating a culture that reflects your values and goals. As a member of the TOC one-on-one coaching program, you'll also gain access to our thriving TOC community, where you can connect with other coaches from around the world, participate in book studies and roundtable discussions, as well as access a wealth of resources designed to help you build a winning culture. If you're ready to take your coaching to the next level and create an extraordinary culture for your team or organization, we'd love to hear from you. Visit tocculture.com/workwithus to learn more about the TOC one-on-one coaching program, or you can find more information at tocculture.com. Links to both of these sites will be included in the details of this episode. Yeah, I love that. You probably wouldn't be surprised, but there's some coaches out there in the world that actually I've heard that they don't give the employees or their assistant coaches feedback directly. They go tell it to the other person and have them pass it along. It's painful when I hear that.
That is manipulative insincerity right there. That's cowardice is what that is.
Yeah, absolutely. There's one thing. I love the framework you just laid out there. It's so practical and something that I think every coach can really like, you know, it starts with soliciting feedback, right? It just building that trust through that. There's one part that I think I would struggle with, and that is with certain athletes or employees, you know, this finding praise. Sometimes it can feel like when we're really struggling with someone in our organization or a team to praise something that we're just making stuff up. It seems almost insincere. You know, what do you do when you're in a situation where you're really, you know, struggling to find things to praise? You got any advice for us?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and you're exactly right. Your praise does need to be specific and sincere. So think about this. What's one thing this person does that you want them to do more of? And give voice to that. Russ Laraway, who I worked with at Google and then started a company with at one point, he was an avid little league coach, and he had this thing called the book. And at the during a game, he would write down three things that each kid did right during the game. And at the end of the game, he would read those things to everyone. It was public praise. It was sort of explaining to these kids what good looks like. And I think building that habit of looking for, you want to really look for the things that people are doing right, can help enormously. And just in turn, because it is a muscle, building praise often can feel patronizing. And I think for a lot of us, receiving praise can feel uncomfortable, actually. And you got to get past that. I was talking to Andy Grove once. He was the CEO of Intel. And he said he had been CEO for a few years. And one night, somebody snuck into his cubicle and nailed a sign to the wall that said, "Say something nice." And he realized that he had just failed in this, and that was actually an important part of leadership was pointing out the things that were going well, because it, like, your job as a leader is to paint a picture of what's possible, to convince the team that they can win. And it turns out that praise is a much better tool for that than criticism. But if you're using praise as in the shit sandwich sense of the word, then you're just going to be like trying to say something nice so that you can say the thing you really want to say. And that's not really praise. Another hint about praise is that if it's something you would say to your dog, it's not good praise. Like, good job doesn't count. So you want to, with both praise and criticism, you want to be humble. You're not the arbiter of what's good or bad, but you're sharing with everyone what you observed. And you also want to know what they observed. It's a dialogue, not a monologue. You want to state your intention to be helpful. You want to do this in a synchronous way. You want to do this in person or synchronously. You want to do it right away. You don't want to hold on to things for a long time. You want to praise in public criticize in private, but you've got to correct in public. Like there are certain moments in a game when a kid's head is not in the game or an adult's head is not in the game. And you need to intervene in the moment, you know? And I think that is good coaching. And I think it feels to the parents of the kid who's getting that correction hard to hear. So like some understanding that it's hard for the parents, but they have to suck it up also at a certain level. And then you want to make sure that you don't give either praise or criticism about someone's personality. You want to use situation, behavior, impact, or we call it CORN at Radical Candor: context, observation, result, next step. So in the game, you know, when you almost missed the base, it worried the hell out of the rest of us, like, do better next time, is criticism. But in the game, you know, when you did this thing right, you know, it not only did it win us a run, but it changed the whole morale of the team and helped us win the game. Do more of that. So I think you want to make sure that you're using the same discipline that you would bring to bear when criticizing someone. You want to use the same discipline when praising them. You want to make sure you have the facts right. You want to make sure you're being really specific and really sincere.
I appreciate that rule of thumb about communicating with our dog, because my dog only speaks in profanity. So that's a good rule of thumb for me when I'm coaching my daughter's fourth grade team.
Yes, yeah. I was going to say profanity is a big one, because I'm prone to it myself. But remembering that good communication gets measured not at your mouth, but at the listener's ear. And you know, sometimes profanity is fine. And with fourth grade kids, it's probably not so cool. As we saw in Ted Lasso. Ted Lasso, by the way, is a poster man of Radical Candor. I love that show.
Well, there's one more quote that I wanted to ask you about before we get you out of here. And I'm going to put this a little into my own context, and you may apply it differently. But I think sometimes as a leader, as we start to encourage more feedback and more, you know, honesty in these conversations, I think sometimes we can bruise. And if we've been bruised before, we might be able to bruise a little more easily without doing a little bit of our own inner work, if that makes sense. And you know, you had a quote in there that said, everyone is watching you, but that doesn't mean it's always about you. And I think every time I get an email from a parent, you know, or a player decides they don't want to play basketball or whatever it might be, immediately I assume that it's because of me.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that that's an assumption that serves me as a leader. So maybe you could unpack that a little bit more for us.
Yeah, you know, I think that when you become a leader, one of the things that happens is that you become the projection screen for everyone's unresolved authority issues. And so the kids who you're coaching have their authority issues with their parents, but their parents also have authority issues from when they were, you know, they still have trauma from whatever happened in their own childhood, a lot of them. And it's not, you know, it's not your fault. On the one hand, other people's authority issues are not your fault, but it is your problem. And so learning how to be kind of an emotional shock absorber in these situations, like you are going to take some heat that's not fair. And realizing that this is not about something you did. It's about something that has happened in this other person's life. And the more you can bring compassion to that instead of getting mad about it, the better. I mean, so for example, there was a time when I was leading a team, and we were coming up with tagline. We were doing some marketing work for our product, and we came up with a tagline, and I felt good about it, but not great about it. And then I woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I had a much better idea. So I came in the next morning. I'm all excited. I'm like, I got a much better idea. And the marketing person burst into tears, and she was like, I've already printed the t-shirts. And I was like, at first I was tempted to be mad and to think she was being ridiculous. And then I took a step back and I was like, all right, what's going on? Like, what's going on here? This is not about the t-shirt, something else. And then I got some real feedback once I didn't blame her for her reaction. And I realized she was right. I kept changing my mind about everything every 5 minutes, and I was making it harder for the team to do their best work. And that was what she was mad about. And that was legitimate feedback. But I had to get past my sort of reaction to the emotion. And by the way, she had had a couple of other bosses who were just total jerks. And so I had to prove to her that it was safe for her to offer me this criticism. And it was also safe for her to be emotional with me, because if I hadn't known about the emotion, then I wouldn't have asked the follow-up questions, and then I wouldn't have learned something important.
Mm. That's a great story. I love that, and really inspiring. The book Radical Candor is at the top of my list because I think it really does provide a system for leaders it's not just, you know, it's about feedback, it's about handling criticism, it's about building relationships. It's so comprehensive. But you found it in you to write another book, Just Work.
Yes.
So tell us about Just Work and, you know, yeah, I want to hear all about it.
Yeah. So if you're going to write a book about feedback, you're going to get a lot of it. And indeed, I did. And I believe that feedback is helpful, and it helped me improve my thinking. So one of the most valuable bits of feedback I got happened shortly after the book came out. I was giving a talk at a tech company in San Francisco. And the CEO of that company had been a colleague of mine for the better part of a decade, a person I like and respect enormously, and one of too few Black women CEOs in tech, or frankly, in any other sector. And when I finished giving the presentation, she pulled me aside and she said, Kim, I'm excited about Radical Candor. I think it's going to help me build the kind of culture I want. But I got to tell you, it's much harder for me to roll it out than it is for you. And she went on to explain to me that as soon as she would offer anyone, even the most compassionate, gentle criticism, someone would accuse her of being an angry Black woman. And I knew this was true, and I knew how unfair it was, because she's like one of the most even-keeled, cheerful people I've ever worked with. And as soon as she said that to me, I had kind of four revelations at the same time. The first was that I had not been the kind of colleague that I imagined myself to be, that I want to be. I had failed to be an upstander. I had failed even to notice the extent to which she was experiencing sort of bias, prejudice, and bullying, because I didn't want to think of her as a victim. The second thing I realized was that not only did I not want to think of her as a victim, I didn't want to think of myself as a victim. So I'd also been in denial about the kinds of things that happened to me as a white woman leader in the workplace. The third thing that I realized was that I really didn't want to think of myself as a victim, but even less did I want to think of myself as a culprit. And so I was most deeply in denial about the times in which I had said or done things that were biased or that bullied other people, which we've all done those things. I mean, these are universal human problems. And then the fourth thing that I realized was that I always imagined as a leader, I was creating these BS-free zones where everybody could do their best work and love working together. But I had failed because I had failed to recognize the extent to which bias, prejudice, and bullying masquerade as feedback. And so that was why when we were talking about people who cross the line from criticism to bullying you, like how to deal with that, because it is a line that shouldn't be crossed, and that it's a leader's job to prevent from being crossed.
Mm, that's really, really powerful. And, you know, as a white male myself, I, you know, have limited experience in that, but just even having conversations with my wife in the workplace there and what it's like to work as a female in leadership, I've been able to hear a lot of those challenges as well too. So, you know, if there was just one thing you would really kind of leave us with today that kind of really just is probably more of a practical, I don't know if it's a practical suggestion or just one core idea that you think that every coach really needs to hear that might encourage them to go out and read that book as well. You know, what would that idea be?
I think I'm going to give you two, if that's okay. The first one is solicit feedback. If each of your listeners can think about what's the question that they are going to ask, you know, what could I do or stop doing that would make it easier for you to work with me? Figure out how you're going to add, and don't say, do you have any feedback for me? Because I can already tell you the answer to that question. Oh, no, everything's fine. So, but don't write down the question I just said either. Think about your own words. How are you going to ask? What's the question you're going to ask? Write it down. Write down who you're going to ask it of and when you're going to ask it. If you can do that, it will do more than anything else to set you down your path towards radical candor. The other thing that I would say is take a book out of Russ Laraway's take a page out of his book and start the book. Like, really look for things to praise, because that is what is going to inspire kids to do their best work when they know you're noticing their great work.
All right, that's it for our conversation with Kim Scott. You can get her book, Radical Candor, and her latest book, Just Work, anywhere you buy books. I highly recommend Radical Candor. It's a very, very practical system for leadership. And honestly, when it comes to practical books on leadership, it's definitely in my top three of all time. So huge thanks for Kim Scott coming on the podcast. All right, that's it for today's episode of the Coaching Culture Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Also, we're grateful for people who take 15 to 30 seconds just to leave us a review. And I know your friends appreciate it when you send them an episode that they find valuable. So don't hesitate to share today's episode.